You're going to spring break, girl.
I am?
I want to go with you, Becky.
You do?
Let's go. We never went to spring break in college. Spring break, Canada!
Come on in. Kick back. Enjoy yourself.
Hello, and welcome to episode 13, the Spring Break Edition of Notes from the Aisle Seat, the podcast that covers the arts in Northern Chautauqua County, sponsored by the 1891 Fredonia Opera House. My name is Tom Lachlan, and I'm your host as we bring you news and information about arts events at the Opera House and around the region, including interviews with artists and creators across the county. It seems like the arts have taken a bit of a spring break here in the region, but we did manage to find a few events and people to put together this episode. If you don't have triskaidekaphobia, then stick around and give this 13th episode a listen. We'll check out the exhibit at the Marion Art Gallery, talk with another New York State Council on the Arts Award winner, and wrap up with a look at the upcoming cinema series.
I'll go home and pack my panties. You go home and get your scanties, and away we'll go. Ooh. Off we're gonna shuffle, shuffle off to Buffalo.
To Niagara in a sleeper, there's no honeymoon that's cheaper, and the train goes slow.
Ooh.
Off we're gonna shuffle, shuffle off to Buffalo.
As a city, one seldom thinks of Buffalo as having a significant art scene. And yet, in many ways, the amount of visual and performing art being created in Buffalo is remarkably surprising. The Kathy and Jesse Marion Art Gallery currently features a slice of that talent with the exhibition New Shapes from Old Tropes, featuring the work of Buffalo visual artist curated by John Messier, visual arts curator at Hall Walls Contemporary Art Center in Buffalo. I spoke with John about his vision for the exhibit. I have with me John Messier. John is the visual arts curator for the Hall Walls Contemporary Arts Center in Buffalo. John, welcome to the podcast. It's very good to have you.
Great to be here.
So let's start the conversation by talking about the contemporary art scene in Buffalo in general. I imagine you've been there for quite some time, and perhaps you can give us some insight on what you think makes the arts community there particularly unique.
You know, Buffalo, as you know, as maybe many of your listeners know, is a Rust Belt city, a former Steel Belt city that from, say, 1950 until the 21st century was in kind of regular decline as an urban site, as a place of growth and renewal. But that's turned around in the last 20 years. We're still a very poor city. But we're still the second largest city in New York State. And even through the hardest times, if you go back 40 years, 50 years, Buffalo has a very rich history of contemporary art in all media. Maybe part of the reason for that is being not the most prosperous place as you measure cities, it becomes an affordable place to be an artist and to create work. And so I think that has been a sustaining factor over time. And as far as the visual arts is concerned, Buffalo, I would say, has a disproportionate number of galleries and venues that show contemporary visual art, at least according to the size of our city. You know, Rochester isn't that much smaller than Buffalo, but has far fewer venues in terms of visual art. And so Buffalo has always got something percolating. I've been in Buffalo for 20 years now, and really I could say that it is, it kind of defies its own expectations in a way. There is always a lot going on. And I would say the arts has always been very active and very prosperous. And it's kind of nice to see. I mean, it's and it happens at all age levels. You know, there's a lot of emerging artists in Buffalo. There's a lot of mid-career artists. There's a lot of senior artists that have been around for a while. So you do get a really nice mix of that too. You know, it's not like it's just like, you know, a hip gentrified place that doesn't have a diversity of approaches and diversity of artists. We fully have that, you know. There's a big wall painted mural on the side of a building downtown that's really big, and it's just a text piece, and it says, "Keep Buffalo a secret," you know, it's a double-edged sword. You want your place that you're in to prosper and to grow, but there is something to be said for the place that nobody thinks about, the place that is a secret, the place that is open ground in terms of possibility, in terms of trying things, in terms of experimenting.
Well, let's get into your exhibit that you have down here in Fredonia at SUNY Fredonia called New Shapes from Old Tropes. And perhaps you can give us sort of an overview of the aim of the exhibit, what it's trying to accomplish, and where the title fits in and how that works in the whole overall scheme of it.
The director at the gallery, Barbara Raker, had contacted me and asked me if I would be interested in doing a show for them that was kind of a group show showcasing Buffalo artists. So I started making a working list of artists that I would like to put in a group situation that I thought were among the best artists in Buffalo or the most consistent and the most interesting. And that list was a lot longer than, you know, the number of artists that ended up in the show. But as I looked at my list, the thing that was interesting to me was that in one way or another, I could shuffle these artists that I had written down into either deviations or iterations of landscape or figuration. The reason that was interesting to me was because I think in contemporary art, we sometimes think of those motifs as old-fashioned, as traditional, as well-worn, as past their prime, past their best buy date, and you know, maybe they don't sound innovative as approaches. But the truth really is that those motifs or those tropes, those old tropes, they persist for a reason, because they're stable. There's always interesting things to be done from that point of view. So because I didn't want to corral everybody around a Best of Buffalo theme, I decided to corral them around those two points of departure, figuration and landscape. And sometimes, you know, some are more more obviously connected to those tropes, and some are way more, you know, far out from those tropes, but they all connect to them somehow. And I wanted it to be a kind of fulsome show. I think I have 11 or 12 artists in the show, because I knew that there's a pretty good art program in Fredonia, so there are a lot of art students. And with something like this, this kind of group show that is, you know, presented along these ideas, I wanted the students to have a lot to chew on.
Well, let's get into the meat of the show here. I went and I saw the show, picked out the exhibition, spent some time with it, and I thought perhaps that I would discuss a little bit about some of the things that caught my eye, some of the artists that caught my eye. And the first one that really caught my eye, because, you know, his portrait is like right there at the entrance, is Bruce Adams. What is it about his work that you find interesting?
Bruce, who sadly passed away a year ago from thyroid cancer, is a longtime Buffalo artist. What I found interesting about his work, and I knew Bruce very well, and I spent a lot of time in his studio with him, is that there's a thing called the pictures generation, which includes Cindy Sherman, includes Robert Longo, includes a bunch of artists from the 80s. And it's centered around an exhibition that happened in New York. And I don't remember what, I think it was the early 90s, that was called the pictures generation. And that kind of defined a certain generation of artists who were you know, using representational imagery, using media references, using quotation and excerptation in their work as a visual language. And that, you know, if you Google pictures generation, you'll find a pretty fulsome description of the, of what that denotes. Mm-hmm. And, but it's very New York centric. But when I thought about it, I thought, you know, Bruce, he's a contemporary of those artists. He is a member of the pictures generation. It's his work is sort of deceptive in that he always uses, and here's our springboard from figuration. He always uses the figure in some manner. People could be forgiven for thinking he was essentially a figurative painter. But he was much more than that, because as you see in the pieces in this show, there are, as you cite, other images, other objects in the paintings. And he was very determined not to enforce a particular meaning on a painting. He really believed in the audience, the viewer, kind of completing the meaning of the painting. So, you know, I think that, you know, his work is significant, and there will be a show, kind of a small retrospective of his work coming up at the Birchfield Penny in July of this year.
Well, let's move on to another one of the artists that I thought was kind of, interesting to me, and that's Julia Bottoms. Julia's has two portraits there, so she's also dealing in the portraiture, the trope of portraiture, and there are two portraits of one is of a Black female and one is of a Black male, and they're both nudes and. They're haunting in very, very interesting ways. Can you speak a little bit to why you chose those?
Julia has a very consummate skill as a portrait painter, as you can tell. So the female nude, especially when you look at that painting, like she has a world-weary, thousand-yard stare kind of look in her eyes, like she's staring out not at the viewer but into a kind of middle distance, and you can't tell if she's just resigned to something, if she's fed up with something, if she's just tired of something. And you know, that painting is very evocative to me because the background is very splotchy, like there's a lot of little paint patches in the background. And you know, if you look at those paint patches, they're all kind of different skin tones. So that to me was very interesting. She's sort of set against this wall of diverse skin tones and laid bare before it. The male figure in the other painting is, he doesn't have the same thousand-yard stare. I think he's more closely looking at the viewer. But his body is disrupted diagonally with these painterly streaks that are going across, and almost like a video signal that's gone awry, and it's sort of distorting the image of his body. But I really like that gesture because, I mean, I like it just in a painterly sense, but I also like the way it suggests that he's a body in transformation from something into something. And we don't know what, but there's a sense of possibility there. There's a sense of, you know, that it is not, you know, I took it, and I don't know if I'm taking it correctly. And Julie and I didn't talk about this specifically, but the idea of the Black male body has been, you know, changing over the last few years, particularly in terms of certain police actions and certain incidents that have taken place and certain murders that have occurred and lynchings that have occurred. It kind of redefines and repositions the Black male body as a, you know, something we have to think about, you know, as, you know, in its humanness, in its naked, blatant humanness, and not as an other thing. And so I think, you know, that painterly kind of disruption in the work is, I take it as a positive sign, as something that is suggesting a positive transformative perception. These are both very, in many ways, they're very, I wouldn't say simple, but they're very straightforward portraits that have particular little painterly gestures, like that diagonal streak or the splotching behind behind the female figure. Those are simple gestures, but they're very potent.
Yes.
And so when they're handled by a skilled painter, and Julia is a very, very skilled painter, and she has always, her portraits have always been interesting because they've always been true to the likeness of the person she's painting, but they've also always had these very interesting painterly spaces in them, which are kind of have a little bit of a magical quality to them and have a something that suggests something beyond the straightforward portrait. And I think that's what I sensed in these, you know, this sort of, this broader scope of possibility and what could be and maybe what should be.
And hence the new shape, right?
Oh, new shapes.
There you go. The last artist that is not an individual artist, as I understand, Biro Code. It's a sort of a collective, or at least there's three people I read involved in it.
Well, Biro Code are a collective, basically a husband and wife team of Peter Daria and Andrea Mancuso, who have been working together for 25, 30 years. And in this project, their daughter, Claudia Daria, was helping them. So she's sort of, you know, it's become a family business, I guess, like Biro Code as a collective expands to include the artistic daughter. And Biro Code have always dealt with, or often dealt with, as the name would suggest, Biro Code, with biological imperatives, with germs, with viruses, with things about the body, body horror, body transformation, molecular structures. But they've always had a kind of, I would say, non-judgmental attitude toward these ideas. So in this work, which was shot as they drove across the United States and saw cell towers in different regions. So if you're in the gallery, the left side is the East Coast, and it, as you wind down the piece, the right side is the West Coast, and it goes all across the country. And they're photographing all of these cell towers, as you say. And they became fascinated because they're fascinated with viruses, with the apparent virus of the cell phone towers, which are everywhere. So once you see this piece, if you start looking, like, you'll see them. They're everywhere. And their interesting posture is they call them seedlings. The piece is called Seedlings because that's what these communication devices are doing. They're seeding themselves across our landscape. And someone could, you know, people have hostility toward these sorts of things, as they do with, say, windmills. However, nobody's going to give up their cell phone, and everybody wants better service. And so it's kind of like George Carlin once said about plastic. He said, you know, the earth doesn't care. The earth will just become the earth plus plastic. Like, it's us that gets affected by that sort of change. And so I think they look at these towers in a objective way as, well, now the place where we live is earth plus cell towers. They are just there. It's kind of a lovely turnaround, you know, to take this thing that really on the surface is the kind of thing people would describe as a visual clutter, as something that is distasteful, something we ideally don't want in our line of sight. and then just turn around and say, well, you know, we might not want it, but it's here. It's not going anywhere. They are seedlings. They're going to proliferate beyond what they are now because we want more of that perfect coverage. So they're not going anywhere. So it's time to, you know, come to terms with this new entity in our midst. It's maybe it's better to find a way to love it and live with it than it is to, you know, put our head in our hands and shake them.
Indeed. John, thank you very much for your time. I appreciate the effort that you put into the work, into curating the exhibit. I think you've come up with something really fine, and I do hope people get a chance to see it. Thank you very much for your time, and maybe we'll get you down again sometime.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
New Shapes from Old Tropes is open now and continues through Sunday, April 10th. Gallery hours are Tuesday through Thursday from noon to 4, Friday and Saturday noon to 6, and Sunday noon to 4. Admission is free. More information along with the websites of the artists mentioned can be found in the show notes for this episode. Getting funding for arts projects is a never-ending struggle for artists, and so when the New York State Council on the Arts awarded two $10,000 grants to two regional artists, it was a stunning and surprising validation of the artwork being created in this region. Phil Hastings, Associate Professor of Film and Video in the Department of Visual Arts and New Media, was awarded one of those $10,000 grants earlier in the year. We talked a bit about his work and what he intends to do with that grant money. It's a great pleasure to welcome Phil Hastings to the podcast, an artist whose work I've been familiar with for quite some time. Hi, Phil. Welcome.
Hello.
So I think the first thing I'm going to ask you to do is just simply to talk about what it is you do. I mean, I hate to use the words or the phrase, shall we say, experimental video, but you work in film in a completely different way than most people think about it.
I definitely think straddle a whole bunch of different approaches to the filmmaking process. So while I do have some narrative experience, and I have some documentary experience and some animation experience, the majority of my work usually is more experimental, which is a term that is thrown around a lot without a lot of consideration, but basically it means anything that's not one of the others. My work is shown a lot in festivals, but also in galleries and museums. And sometimes those have stories to them, but a lot of times they're more visually directed. So that's kind of, in a nutshell, I think how I would approach experimental film and video.
When you create something like that, that has that sort of non-narrative basis to it, what are you usually trying to evoke in the viewer?
I think it depends on the project, but a lot of times I'm very specifically looking at trying to draw out an emotional response. I want them to have a visceral experience of some sort. Maybe it's tied to a memory. Maybe it's tied to an experience that they've had or a similar kind of experience than what I'm projecting. It does vary, though, depending. One of the things that I like to say about the kind of work that I do and what I teach often when there's questions about that versus narrative is I like to compare a narrative film to a novel. But I like to compare experimental film and video to poetry. And I think a lot of times people understand the difference between those two. They both evoke stories. They both evoke feelings and emotions, but they approach it in different ways. And I think that's kind of really what we're trying to do when we're making our work.
So I do have to congratulate you on having gotten a $10,000 grant from the New York State Council on the Arts. That's a pretty prestigious and certainly, you know, a good chunk of change to be able to have to continue your work. Which particular piece got that award for you? What do you project using that money for and moving forward?
So thank you. It is a great honor and a surprise. You know, you're always applying for grants. You're always trying to find funding. And so when something like this does happen, it's a really wonderful experience. The film is tentatively right now called Tether, and it is a narrative film. Although I will say it's a more of an experimental narrative film. I just realized that we've actually had some of what we talked about in the past is connected to this. I'll bring it all around.
Great.
It's basically inspired by the experiences of the pandemic, and the idea of the lockdown and the idea of not being able to effectively communicate between people, where we've lost our connections. And I found it really interesting that there was this reliance on things like Zoom, and we could see each other and we could communicate. And in fact, I taught for a year and a half that way, mm-hmm. Which is an interesting experience in and of itself. But at the same time, you know, it was effective, but it wasn't completely effective. And there was certainly something that was lost. And then the question was, well, you know, a lot of students actually preferred it. They liked the security of not having to leave the house during the pandemic. And I probably did too at some point. So that idea of whether the experience is a good experience or a bad experience or just an experience, I thought was something that I wanted to explore. I'd been doing my more experimental work for a number of years, and it's been a long time since I've done a narrative film. And I had a plan, and this is the plan that you and I had talked about at one time. And this has really kind of evolved out of that, I think, the same kind of process. I wanted it to be a project that was tied to the pandemic and tied to the lockdown. In a sense, I was using it as a way to see if I could continue to be creative. I was using it as a form of therapy. You know, some people were baking bread and learning an instrument or something. And so I was coming up with this idea. And I know a lot of artists and filmmakers have done projects that are related to the pandemic. And there's some really interesting ones that have come out. But I wanted to do it by myself. So I wanted to say, okay, well, if you can't have anybody, can you still be creative and can you still make a narrative film? And so my intent is, always was and still is, to be the director of it, be the cinematographer, be the editor, the production designer, the set builder, but also the actor, right? And so I am basically the only person that will be involved in the film.
You're the show.
I'm the show, which is really nerve-wracking and scary because, okay, it fails. It fails because of me. I can't blame anybody. but I think it's, I'm kind of excited about the challenge. It's going to give me an opportunity to learn a lot of new things. I have been, I've been exploring, you know, the idea of acting in the past. I've done a little bit of it. And I find that using the body to kind of play out emotions much more dance-like, mm-hmm. Is a way for me to really kind of understand things. So I don't know. We'll see how it goes. But right now, the grant itself is going to be used for production. So I will be continue to be building the set, working on costumes, working on props. It is a piece that relies on all of these things. It's not found objects. It's not my living room, so to speak, or my backyard. It's actually a set that I'm building. It all takes place in one room, and it is a conversation between two people.
Hmm.
And this is the story that you and I had talked about a long time ago when I was pitching another film. And I said it was a cross between My Dinner with Andre and David Lynch.
And, yeah, I remember that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yes. And I think it's still that. It is, you know, it's a different story, but that idea of what happens in that film with two people sitting around a dinner table talking. I still have visual memories of those stories in my head, which I find really fascinating because it was never shot. It's just the stories that were told.
Right.
And that idea of storytelling and that idea of painting pictures in people's heads is also a really interesting, you know, experiment, I think, for film, because in film, typically they say show, don't tell. And so now what we're going to do is we're going to show one thing, but we're going to be telling a completely different thing. And then what's the connection between the two? So, and there is a connection. So,
well, fascinating. Now, when you take on a project like this, where you're doing all of it, what's the time frame? I mean, how long are you going to be working on this?
A very, very long time. it's taking a long time. And that was partially intentional. I have been, again, I've been working in a format that I felt I was just kind of grinding through ideas and grinding through projects and producing a lot, and realizing that some of my more successful projects were ones that I dedicated a lot of time to. And was kind of thinking, well, I need to get back to that. So I gave myself permission and said, this is going to take however long it takes. Mm-hmm. And you don't have anything that you have to get done. You don't have to be producing work for a show or anything that's coming up. So take the time and do this. And so that's kind of how it started. It's taking longer than I expected, only because of life and everything else. Mm-hmm. It gets in the way. So the set is, I would say, like 80% done. The script is a good chunk of it is done, and I'm feeling pretty good about where it's going. I've got it laid out visually, what's happening. So the next step is just kind of wrapping up all of the pre-production stuff. And then my hope, if I'm lucky enough, my hope is that I will be going on sabbatical in the fall, mm-hmm. and that'll give me time to finish that work. Take advantage of the grant, which is specifically for 2022, and purchase needed materials and supplies, and then start shooting early 23, with the idea of finishing it up probably late 23 or early 24. Wow. So yeah, it's a long project, but I'm trying not to think about the time too much.
Well, no, I commend you for just taking the time to put the project in and make it what you want it to be at this point, because I think, you know, every artist looks for that. They want their project to be what they want it to be. And the fact that you actually are going to have like total control over that, well, you have to give yourself time to do that.
Yeah. I keep telling people that, well, the final step will be I need to learn music and learn how to play an instrument so that I can do the score. So that would, I don't know if that'll be the case or not. We'll see. But I've certainly made films without scores. So.
One of the interesting things that I've noticed as I've watched more and more films is how much the score does, having a score tends to influence something one way or the other. And you find that sometimes if the score is there, I don't know. To a certain extent maybe it's because I come from a theater background, but I look at dialogue to make the connection rather than somebody putting a score back and making me feel something as opposed to, you know.
Exactly. I love sound design. I definitely love sound design and enjoy doing that. So that'll certainly be a big part of it. And that kind of edge where sound design and soundtrack merge, mm-hmm. I think is a really interesting moment. But yeah, to have a full orchestra or something, that's certainly not the type of film this is. So,
no, it's certainly an ambitious project. Do you have anything else going on the side, or does this take up all of your time now?
I So I tend to work in kind of fits and spurts, and I will work on this for a long time, and then I will need to take like a little break, and I'll do a little project on the side, or go back to something that I've been playing around with, other ideas, do that for a few weeks, and then clear my head, and then go back into the writing or the building or whatever. But those are little side things, that and, you know, taking care of the house and taking care of the family and those things.
Right. Yeah. And also your students, run the film program over in the Department of Visual Arts and New Media. And so, you know, just having the time to take your students and look at their work. How's that coming along?
It's coming along great. You know, the program has, is evolving. It's changed. It's gotten bigger. We've got some really nice work that's coming out of what the students are doing. We have some new facilities and have kind of moved into those in the last few years and really taking advantage of that. But yeah, you know, teaching is, I mean, I love teaching. I absolutely love teaching. But it does take time. It does take a time, and it does take, especially when you're trying to innovate, it takes a lot of extra time because you're constantly, you know, building new things or new ideas, and that takes some time. But I get fulfillment out of that, and I get to use this project as a way of teaching, especially my advanced level students, so they get to see kind of the thought process and what I'm going through to make things happen. Yeah.
It's always good for the students to be able to see the work of their professors and come down and take a look at it, because it's usually pretty instructive for them in some way, shape, or form, I'm sure.
I agree.
Well, listen, Phil, thanks very much for coming on. Once again, congratulations. I can't tell you how thrilled I am you've got this $10,000 grant, because I know how hardworking you are. And I know that, you know, what you do is so on the fringe that to be recognized for, you know, the work that you have done and to get a chunk of change to do this big project, you really deserve it, man. And I'm very happy to see that you got it.
I appreciate that, Tom. That means a lot to me. It really does.
Good.
Thanks.
Good. Welcome. Okay. So good luck. And when you get that thing done, let me know, because we'll have to get you back on the podcast to talk about it again.
All right. Sounds good.
Thanks for your time, Phil. Bye-bye.
See you.
Here's what else is going on in the arts in the region for the next 2 weeks. Sue Tillotson and Jim Cunningham of Waterhorse, along with the Bonnie Loch Fiddlers, will be performing a concert of Scottish and Irish music in celebration of St. Patrick's Day on Friday, March 18th, 2022, at 7:30 p.m. at the 1891 Fredonia Opera House. Tickets are still available for the concert and are $17 for adults, $15 for Opera House members, and $10 for students. For more information, download episode 12 of the podcast for an interview with Sue and Jim. Also at the Opera House, the Art and Architecture series presents a documentary entitled Napoleon, In the Name of Art. Marking the 200th anniversary of Napoleon's death, the film takes a look at the intersection of art, history, and culture in Napoleon's time. The documentary will be screened on Saturday, March 19th at 1 p.m. Tickets are $15 for adults and $10 for students. Finally, the Western New York Chamber Orchestra, under the baton of Maestro Glenn Cortese, presents its third concert of the season, Classics 3, on Sunday, March 27th at 4 p.m. in the King Concert Hall of the Rockefeller Arts Center. Tickets for events at the Opera House can be purchased online at www.fredopera.org/tickets or by calling the box office at 716-679-1891. Tickets for all campus events can also be purchased online at www.fredonia.edu/tickets or by calling the campus box office at 716-673-3501. If you'd like your arts events mentioned on the podcast, just send us an email at operahouse@fredopera.org. Please allow 4 weeks advance notice for a timely mention. The cinema series has two films coming up in the next couple of weeks. Dog, starring Channing Tatum,
tells the story of an ex-Army Ranger who wants to return to the unit and is tasked with taking an Army-trained dog to the funeral of a fellow soldier. Death on the Nile, directed by and starring Kenneth Branagh, is a filmed version of the famous Agatha Christie novel featuring Detective Hercule Poirot. And who better to talk about these two films than Paul Preston of The Movie Guys?
Once again, to talk about the cinema series, I have with me Paul Preston. I should point out that I think that, Paul, you're a graduate of SUNY Fredonia. 1992, is that correct?
Just in case casting directors are watching this, let's say 2002.
No. Okay.
Let's 1992 say is correct. Do the math.
That's all right, because if you're a graduate of 1992, they can do the math on me too. So it works out for both of us, right?
We're both going down a hole there.
Okay. We're both going down that hole. So it's as always, it's a pleasure to have you on the program as a resident movie expert. And we got two movies coming up in the cinema series at the 1891 Opera House coming up. A movie entitled Dog, and then one that I'm sure the title is very familiar with most people, the Agatha Christie novel, Death on the Nile. So let's just get it rolling. We'll start with Dog. I think it seems like an interesting film to me, but I can't tell if it's a buddy film, an animal film, a buddy animal film. I mean, what do we got here, Paul?
You're right on all three. Well, last time we covered Belfast, West Side Story, so some of the Oscar stuff, and now you get into February, you just don't know what you're going to get. January usually is the dumping ground of, well, this wasn't going to work during the holidays, and we're not saving it till summer, so put it out in January. February, sometimes you get some good stuff, sometimes you get some iffy stuff, I don't know. So Dog has been delayed a number of times for COVID, like a whole year, I believe, and now it's come out in February, and I say go and seek it out, because it looks like you watch the trailer, no doubt, a fun romp road picture with Channing Tatum and a dog, but it actually addresses deeper issues to the film's credit. And I'll give you a brief what it's about in case you haven't seen the trailer, but Channing Tatum plays Jackson Briggs. He's an Army Ranger. He's no longer serving because of injury, but he really wants back in. He wants to be part of the battalion again, but they keep turning him down. And one way to get consideration, however, is to do the military a favor. There's this dog named Lulu who served on many dangerous overseas missions. And the dog needs to be delivered from Oregon to Arizona to the funeral of a veteran who served with Briggs. And deliver the dog successfully, the proper phone calls will be made. You can be an Army Ranger again. And as you can imagine, road trip shenanigans ensue. And the film has, wacky dialogue when they stop in Portland and they do a bunch of Portlandia type jokes about the earthy, crunchy liberals there. And then he tries to have a date, a number of times it goes kerfloogie and the dog doesn't help matters. So, but when it circles back around to really what's important, doubling down on the more compelling elements, Briggs and the dog both having PTSD. It's a strong statement about the structure of the military and what the military brings to the lives of soldiers. They want back into it, regardless of the panic attacks that they show the character having throughout the film. So even though he has that, he just can't wait to get back in uniform. And again, I think by balancing, smartly addressing all that and having fun with the road picture, it ends up being a really enjoyable movie.
I did notice, though, that Channing Tatum seems to headline it. There aren't a lot of other names, big names, though, that I was able to recognize. Some of the other players in the movie. Am I missing something there?
You're not. There's a whole lot of who in this one. Jane Addams pops up. I don't know if you know her, but she was a big sort of supporting actress staple in film and TV for a long time. She had a long run as Niles' sort of conniving fiance on Frasier for a while, but among other things, Ethan Suplee is in it as well, who was in My Name is Earl. But it all comes down to centering around Tatum and the dog. And I'm used to bigger stars sort of going all in on the center of attention like that, like Tom Hanks in Castaway or Will Smith in I Am Legend. But Tatum pulls it off. I mean, he's really charismatic and honors the veteran with this sort of worthy, realistic performance of what someone like that is going through. And Tom, if you think these two aren't going to learn from each other, think again. You think the dog won't make Channing Tatum a better person? Think again, because that's what they want to do. They pull out the crowd pleasing charm of the movie, as well as you know, what's really going on under the surface.
Well, that's an interesting concept, because I did not, when you look at the trailer, you don't get a sense that it goes as deep as that. You do get a sense that this is going to be like, you know, as I say, I saw a mixture of, you know, buddy picture, road picture, all kinds of different tropes, just sort of like thrown together to feature Channing Tatum, who's, you know, pretty handsome actor, ripped, all that kind of stuff. But
perhaps more handsome than he was even 10 years ago, which is gross. Come on, dude. Make some room. Make some room. The rest of us.
But so what you're saying is that the movie will surprise people who go to see it, will probably be surprised by the depth of it.
Well, I was. I've now spoiled that for you. But without, but regardless, just know that going in, that you're going to be pleased by both parts of that. Look, Tatum, he came up in movies like Step Up, which was a hokey teen dance movie, and he's been in some romance, some Nicholas Sparks adaptations. But I'm impressed that when it's a project that's him, like this is his co-directorial debut with somebody named, I want to get the name right, Reed Carolyn. Reed Carolyn has been his producing partner for a while. Those two co-direct this movie, and Tatum co-produces it. So he's put his money and his star power into a vehicle that he believes in. And I'm glad that when he does that, it's not another Step Up movie or another hacky romance. Like, it's something that is a great mix of comedy and drama with neither really diluting the impact of the other. It has benefited him. And if you feel like you haven't seen Channing Tatum for a while, you haven't. He was in Free Guy last summer in a smaller part, but I was like, Channing Tatum, where's he been? Sure enough, like 2017 was the last thing he was in that was the Kingsman sequel. And so it had been a while, but now he's back. He's great in Free Guy. He's great in this. And I guess he's got some new action movie with Sandra Bullock coming up as well. So Tatum has returned.
Okay. Well, that's all to the good. Yeah. Another person who's returning, and we talked about some of his work the last time as one of the megastars these days is Kenneth Branagh. We've got him once again directing and starring in Agatha Christie's Death on the Nile as the very famous and well-known detective Hercule Poirot. I practiced my French.
And I can only say, I think you're right.
Tell us a little bit about this film. This film seems to have like just gorgeous cinematography and an all-star cast.
Yeah, I mean, he did the same thing with Murder on the Orient Express when he brought in Penelope Cruz and Johnny Depp and Daisy Ridley and Michelle Pfeiffer and on and on and on, star for star. He does the same here. So it seems like it's going to be his thing. And I'm not mad at Kenneth Branagh for just taking on these Agatha Christie movies. They're big and splashy and tons of fun. But it's kind of interesting that the last time I was on here and we talked about Kenneth Branagh, I mentioned that he was kind of a two-headed directorial beast. He takes these kind of heady swings towards artistic works that yield big results like Henry V and Much Ado About Nothing. And then he seemingly feeds this never-ending want to be a big splashy Hollywood name with movies like Mary Shelley's Frankenstein and Dead Again, which are more, right down the middle. Mm. It's funny, in the first two appearances on the show, in such close proximity, we get to see both Kenneth Branaghs. So we saw the style and substance of Belfast and the style of Death on the Nile. So if you saw Murder on the Orient Express, pretty much this picks up right after that. After that murder mystery, Poirot wants just to get away. And through meeting old friends and making some new friends, he ends up on this river cruise on the Nile, celebrating the wedding of a wealthy heiress. And the reception gets Poirot and the audience caught up on who everybody on board is at this wedding party. We got people who've populated the heiress's past. We've got relatives. We got people with axes to grind. Next thing you know, Tom, murder. And if you know Agatha Christie, another murder and another, et cetera. So, but the way he's pulling these off, I might as well do. And then there were none next. Keep going down the.
Just keep going down the Agatha Christie hit list.
And actually, did Belfast have the Oscar nominations it had last time we talked?
No. We did
think
not.
It did. So that was nominated for Best Picture, and so was West Side Story from the last show. And it should be noted, Kenneth Branagh, like following his career probably in Shakespeare, like you may have back really before Henry V, it's interesting to see that he, even at the top of this, you said another big Hollywood star. It's like, hey, Kenneth Branagh, because now he has been nominated in 7 different categories, which is a record. He was nominated for actor for Henry V and director for Henry V as well. Then he was nominated for a short film in 1993 called Swan Song, which I got to look up. I've never seen it. He was nominated for adapted script for Hamlet, supporting actor for My Week with Marilyn. And now Picture gives him a producer nomination and original script for Belfast. So that's 7. That's no one else has done that.
Wow.
And it's crazy to think this like really serious, excellent stage actor suddenly has this film resume that's just bananas. So, but I talked about sort of Belfast as a style and substance, and Death on the Nile is just style. And that's because sometimes there are some questionable calls with the CGI. You mentioned the gorgeous cinematography, but when you watch it, the CGI pyramids and sort of the exotic locations look a little green screeny. And, you know, here's a tip. Go to Egypt. You know, my favorite movie of all time, right? Raiders of the Lost Ark. They got dysentery, Tom. They went to Asia. And they got dysentery. Go get dysentery. Your movie will be better. Because even by the time they circled around to Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, they were shooting on green screens. I'm like, this movie just looks fake. It looks bad. It's dopey. And so those are questionable moves by Branagh. But then, you know, at the same time, which is a little, which we need after some cheese ball pyramids, what else he does with his camera in close quarters is really interesting. Like he films a scene of Poirot laying out thoughts to the group on whodunit. And much of it's kind of shot through windows that have sort of beveled edges. So it pixelates and gets fragmented as it pans across the room and he's talking, you know, which is of course just what the killer would want. And Poirot then talks to his buddy Book, who was in the first film in Murder on the Orient Express, played by Tom Bateman. And they're talking about the situation. They sit in these wicker chairs, but they're shot from behind. So you see them through the wicker chairs, again, partially masked, supporting the theme of mystery. Like these little choices probably work on you, whether you see them or not. I'm kind of, I'm one of these guys who loves breaking down movies. So I see that and I go, oh, that's really cool. I like the way he did that. I see what I'm supposed to be getting from that. But even if you don't, it's working on you anyway. And that's why I love those choices. So it's a mixed bag of those choices along with big sort of melodrama or cheesy or just unnecessary moves. But let's get to the end point, which is the story wins. You know, this is a murder mystery. I love murder mysteries. I love courtroom dramas. I love sports movies. So whatever sort of quibbles I could have with a choice in filmmaking or a performance or some story thing, once the machinations of that particular genre kick in, whether it's murder mystery, sports, or courtroom, I'm in. You know, and so that's what Death of the Nile delivers, is a solid whodunit. And there's nobody better at it than Agatha Christie. So, you know, for me, stay out of the way best you can with these stories. When he doesn't, that's where it goes. But in the long run, the story wins out and you'll have a lot of fun at the film. Because, you know, the actors are having fun, too. You mentioned the big cast. Gal Gadot, Annette Bening, Rose Leslie from Game of Thrones, Jennifer Saunders and Dawn French, two like queens of British comedy. Russell Brand, Letitia Wright from the MCU. I mean, all these people are having fun, and you as well also join in that.
I only have one more question to ask you about Death on the Nile. What is up with Branagh's mustache for Poirot?
Interesting you should say. Well, he's great because he always is. And, he kind of almost underplays his character's OCD, has his extraordinary politeness. He's even with questionable people, you know, and he has that great thing that you want from Sherlock Holmes or him, is that he sees things that you don't, even though you did. Like, I saw that, but I didn't know that was this, but you saw this, and that's why you're great. And that's why, you know, and so that's totally fun to do. But yeah, there is a whole sort of doubling down on the history of his mustache in this movie. So it's calmed down a little. In Murder, it was huge. It went all the way from, I think, under the nose out to the ears. Mm-hmm. It's calmed a little, but it's still there. But there's this whole backstory to the mustache. Now that sounds cornball, but it's actually one of the things that works really well because it provides, believe it or not, these emotional bookends to the movie. So I was not expecting that to be effective, but it absolutely was. What a weird thing to say, you know, after the first movie, you know, we should explore more is facial hair, but it actually works. And I won't tell you how, but it is great. And I'd be remiss if I didn't shout out for Emma McKee, if I'm pronouncing her name correctly. Amongst all those big stars, you know, you haven't heard of her. I guess she was on a TV show called Sex Education that I didn't watch, but she was sultry and vulnerable as sort of this jaded woman from the groom's past. And man, I thought she was great. So it was fun to watch her as well.
Paul from the Movie Guys, thank you very much for coming around. I really do appreciate your time, and it's always great to have you. Hopefully, you know, I can just keep on doing this over and over when we have movies at the cinema series at the Opera House, because you're obviously a great interview and it's a lot of fun to talk to you.
Damn fine to talk to you.
Damn, you too, Paul. Listen, take care. Enjoy the Hollywood weather, and we'll be talking to you again. Dog, starring Channing Tatum, will be screened on Saturday, March 19th at 7:30 p.m. and again on Tuesday, March 22nd, also at 7:30 p.m. Death on the Nile will be playing on Saturday, March 26th and again on Tuesday, March 29th, both days at 7:30 p.m. Tickets are sold at the door on the night of the show. And if you haven't had a chance to check out Paul's website, just Google The Movie Guys for the most knowledgeable and entertaining YouTube channel on all things Hollywood. You won't regret it. Finally, don't forget to register for the 5th annual 1891 Run for the Fredonia Opera House, which will take place on Sunday, April 24th, 2022, beginning at 9 a.m. The run, or walk if you prefer, is a 5K distance on mostly flat ground through the village of Fredonia and the SUNY Fredonia campus. This year's event will be completely live. There is no virtual option as in the past 2 years. Registration is now open by going to www.fredopera.org and following the links for the 1891 run, or using the link in the show notes for this podcast on its Podbean site at aisleseat.podbean.com. This is a major fundraiser for the Opera House and helps to support all the many programs and event series presented by the Opera House. If you can't make the run, please consider making a donation by following the links to the registration website and making your donation. And that's it for this spring break edition of Notes from the Aisle Seat. My thanks to John Massier, Phil Hastings, and Paul Preston for being my guests on this episode. Notes from the Aisle Seat is a production of the 1891 Fredonia Opera House in Fredonia, New York. For more information on any of the Opera House events, call the box office at 716-679-1891, visit the website at www.fredopera.org, or email at operahouse@fredopera.org. Notes from the Aisle Seat is now available wherever you get your podcasts, including Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher. If you like this podcast, please consider following us by clicking the follow button on our website and spreading the word through your social media feeds. If you have an arts event that you'd like featured on the podcast, why don't you drop us a line at operahouse@fredopera.org, and we'll see about featuring your event. Please try to give us a month's advance notice if possible to facilitate timely scheduling. We'll return in 2 weeks on March 30th, 2022. I'm Tom Laughlin, and until then, be safe out there and be kind to one another.